The wind howled strangely over a midnight tomb. The moon hung like a golden bat over ancient graves, glaring through the wan mist with its baleful, nyctalopic eye. Terrors not of the flesh might lurk among cedar-shrouded sepulchres or creep unseen amid shadowed cenotaphs, for this was unhallowed ground. But tombs hold strange secrets, and there are mysteries blacker than the night and more leprous than the moon. It was in search of such a secret that I came, alone and unseen, to my ancestral vault at midnight. My people had been sorcerers and wizards in the olden days, so lay apart from the resting place of other men, here in this moldering mausoleum in a forgotten spot, surrounded only by the graves of those who had been their servants. But not all the servants lay here, for there are those who do not die.
HPPodcraft.com.
That was the opening of Robert Bloch's The Secret in the Tomb. A story heavily, and I mean heavily, influenced by Robert Bloch's mentor, H.P. Lovecraft. That is why we're talking about this particular story on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at HPPodcraft.com. My name is Chad Pfeiffer.
And my name is Chris Lackey.
You know that last sentence, "But not all the servants lay here, for there are those who do not die." I heard that, and I thought the next thing would be something like, "Thus begins the tale of the undead footman, Mr. Farty Pants."
What? Wait a minute. Why?
Most people with a name like Mr. Farty Pants would die of embarrassment. Not Mr. Farty Pants. There are those who do not die. I think most people who are reasonable would assume that's where the story was going.
Yeah.
But no.
No.
No, this is Robert Bloch, and he is constantly breaking our mundane expectations.
Welcome to our second time stepping into the hoary, fetid tomb of Blocktober. I'm always excited about Blocktober. Firstly, because it marks your birthday.
It does.
As of this recording, will be tomorrow. That's right. When it's released, it will have passed. So happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
But secondly, because we get to dive into some fun post-Lovecraftian joy from Robert Bloch.
It's wondrous. And it's October. The air is getting cooler. Everything is pumpkin flavored. I can wear my little bat wings and roller skates to run errands. People just assume I'm going to a party, which is great. And yeah, my birthday is this week, of course. This is birthday time for a great many people because New Year's Eve happened about 9 months ago.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
we're all mommy's little hangovers.
There you go.
This grouping. But it's a joyous time for a birthday. Truly the most wonderful time of the year when you're a horror fan. One nice birthday treat I got last night, I stopped by the old H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society studio to record and hang out with Mr. Andrew Lehman.
Yes, our reader is the amazing Andrew Lehman. Andrew is working on the Brotherhood of the Beast, which is the Dark Adventure Radio Theater newest production, by far their biggest and most ambitious. It's three CDs and it has four alternate endings. Troy's working on the music now. Sean's doing the sound design. Andrew said he's doing, what, like 50 prop documents for the deluxe version of this. And they're using these vintage Russian military surplus bags from Russia.
I got to see some of the props that are going in the bag as well.
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of thinking, do you remember when you were a kid and you'd look through the toy section of a catalog, like the Spiegel catalog?
Yes.
Or something. And there would be these layouts they would do of certain toy lines like G.I. Joe or the Transformers or Masters of the Universe. And it would have a kid in some smoky, you know, misty playroom that you would never be able to replicate in your own house. And he'd have all the action figures set up. And I would just think, I want all of that. I want all of that right now.
Yeah.
This bag of props they're doing for the Brotherhood of the Beast is kind of like that for a Lovecraftian. I mean, maps, journals, little pins, and it's just mind-blowing the amount of work that they're putting into it. And yeah, those messenger bags are authentic.
So it's going to be really exciting, and I can't wait to finally get to put my ears in it.
It's going to be good stuff. And of course, thank you, Andrew, for reading. He's going to be with us the whole month of Blocktober.
Since today is our first week covering Lovecraftian works of Robert Bloch, we decided to make it a twofer.
Boom.
We're not just going to cover The Secret in the Tomb, but we are also going to cover Suicide in the Study.
Oh dear.
So it's like a machine gun spray of macabre delight.
Whoa, it's pretty violent.
All right, well, let's get started with The Secret in the Tomb. The narrator is this guy who comes from a family of sorcerers. His dad before him, all into magic. It goes all the way back to his great-great-great-great-grandfather, Jeremy Strange. That's right, the narrator's last name is Strange.
Of course it is. He says in a fairly straightforward way, these things about his family. The way you'd say, oh, my grandpa used to be a tailor. You know, he says, my people were sorcerers and wizards. You know, that's where I got the send table. My nana used it to sacrifice animals. Isn't it beautiful? So, like, thrown off that this happens to be his heritage.
Yeah, yeah. So he's gone into this mausoleum, but it's not in the cemetery. It's away from the hallowed ground.
Now, we should pause for a second just to remember the deal with Robert Bloch. I know we've talked about him a lot on the show before. But as everybody knows, you know, he was most famous for writing the novel Psycho, had a very long career writing fiction, film, TV, you name it. He passed away in the 90s. In the 30s, when he was a teenager, he was reading Weird Tales and kind of fell under the spell of Lovecraft's stories.
Yep.
And began writing letters to the old gent. They became correspondents. Bloch wanted to be a writer, and HP was helping him out. So this story, along with The Feast and the Abbey, were Bloch's first professional sales to Weird Tales, and he was 17 years old.
17?
Yeah, which is why I think the writing is slavishly Lovecraftian.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the age when artists are going through their imitation phases. The writing in here is just stuffed with adjectives. Everything is totally overdescribed. It says, the crumbling sepulcher loomed among the brooding trees. I trod the obscure pathway to the vaulted entrance, extinguishing my lantern with malefic fury. I reached the nitrous fungus bearded portals of the family vault. It's Lovecraft on steroids. It's amazing stuff.
He doesn't have the temperance that Lovecraft has.
No, there's no restraint here. No. At all.
This mausoleum has a huge iron door, and he says some words, does a little woo-woo, and then it opens.
Wait. In the story it says, in blind and trembling haste, I chanted the obscure litany and performed the necessary obeisances demanded in the ritual I had learned. And at their conclusion, the cyclopean portal swung open. And again, because he's 17, he hasn't yet learned that all he needed to say was the guy does a little woo-woo and it opens, as you've explained it. That only comes with age, experience, and literary mastery.
Yeah, man, dude. Well, I'm 43, so
yeah.
I know how to handle that.
You know that woo-woo covers all that business.
Covers it all.
Yeah.
So it's dark inside this mausoleum. It's old, and it's creepy.
I sensed that shadows know queer secrets, and there are some skulls that have reason to grin. I don't know what that means.
Before he actually enters this tomb, he gives us a little backstory.
Right, he tells us about this ancestor of his.
Yeah, Jeremy Strange, which Jeremy does not sound very wizardy at all. Years ago, Jeremy came back from the Orient with lots of crazy books and wizard powers. He had this mausoleum built in the creepy part of the woods. He kept a diary about all of his wizard stuff and gave it to his son, who gave it to his son, and so on. All of them eventually went to this tomb, and then none of them ever came back.
That's right. The eldest son of each generation. And they're all after the secret of eternal life. That's what the wizard diaries promised them.
Right.
The wizard diaries coming this fall.
It was a family secret. This whole thing about this tomb and the people going off. They kept their wizarding talk to a minimum, didn't share it with anybody. The first sons were the only ones to know about it, and they were the ones that had to check out the wizarding stuff. But the rest of the family, they were kicking ass, doing well with business, being very successful and rich and all that jazz.
Right. If you were a younger brother or sister, there were no wizard diaries in your life at all. You didn't even know about that stuff. It's just for the eldest son.
So our narrator's mother died at birth, and his father was always bummed about this. So he's kind of a bad dad. He's a bad, sad dad, I guess. But he showed his son all of the spooky books.
Right. He says, I was very young, but not too young to know certain things. There's that repetition of the word certain again. And as I swore to keep the secret, as so many had sworn before me, I had a queer feeling that the time had come for Jeremy to claim his own. For in my father's somber eyes was the same light of dreadful thirst for the unknown, curiosity, and an inward urge that had glowed in the eyes of all the others before him. Previous to the time, they had announced their intention of going on a trip, or joining up, or attending to a business matter. So each eldest son first passes down all the Cthulhu mythos knowledge to the next eldest son, and then after they've done this, they feel the call to go out to the tomb and get that last piece of knowledge about immortality. They can't resist going, even though nobody ever returns.
And he mentions that the books that they read, the Necronomicon, the Book of Iban, the Kabbalah of Sabbath, and of course, Ludwig Prinz's Mysteries of the Worm, which is Robert Bloch's book that he stuck in there with all the other stuff. The narrator's dad laid out that in their family home, he had found a hidden panel in the fireplace that held the diary of Jeremy. Soon after his pa said he went off to Boston for business, but he didn't. He actually went to the tomb. He never came back. So the narrator goes on and studies the diary, tries to figure out what everyone else has missed. Why are they dying? What is so scary about this knowledge?
Yeah, seven generations have gone and disappeared. He is going to be the one to figure it out and come back. He's not going to disappear like they do. And this is a 17-year-old's like cool horror story that we're talking about.
Sure.
But this concept here, I think it speaks to something pretty universal. Because Every generation starts their lives, their adult lives, as an argument against the last. You know, I'm going to be different than my parents.
Sure.
I'm going to succeed where they failed. You're not going to catch me staying in on a Saturday night. And then 20 years later, you're like, thank God they canceled their plans. We're in.
We don't have to go anywhere. So one night he's studying and he gets this crazy urge to go to the tomb. It overwhelms him like some Jedi mind trick. And he goes there alone and weaponless to the tomb.
It's the call. There's nothing he can do about it. He says, I must follow the beguiling voice of inner consciousness that was the invitation and the promise that sounded my soul like the ultra-rhythmic piping of transcosmic music. And I think we talked about this before, but usually when you use a simile, it's to characterize something using another thing that's like relatable. You know, she sang like a bird. His grip was like sandpaper. And here it's the invitation was like the ultra rhythmic piping of transcosmic music. Oh, yeah, I totally get that. Now I understand what the invitation was like. Thanks for making it relatable. Anyway, this sort of gets us back around to the beginning of the story. He's entering the tomb.
When he gets into this dark tomb, all of a sudden he can see. It's just like there's light on inside now. But it's not that he can now see in the darkness, but he can also hear in the darkness and feel things in the dark.
Well, I don't see why you wouldn't be able to hear in the dark.
No, I don't know either, but he does. That's what he says. He feels and hears things that he wasn't able to hear before he entered the tomb.
It was very dark, but I could smell.
So at the center of the mausoleum is a stone slab of black marble, and on that is a gilded coffin. And he knows that whatever he's looking for is in that coffin. So he slides open the lid and he sees this thing in there. The creature with eyes like a midnight demon's. Again, like a midnight demon's. What do I don't know what that looks like. I've never seen a midnight demon. I don't even really understand what that's supposed to mean.
Don't know.
Is that when you see a demon at midnight, its eyes look differently than if you see it at 11:30?
Or is it a different kind of demon that's specifically a midnight demon?
I've got more questions than answers here. Mm-hmm. And a face of loathsome delirium that is like the death mask of a devil. It was smiling too as it lay there, and my soul shrieked in the tortured realization that it was alive.
No!
And not only is it alive, it talks. It's got a creepy hissy voice and it whispers the secrets to him. He says, all was revealed, the secret crypts of blackest nightmare, where the tomb spawn dwell, and of a price whereby a man may become one with the ghouls, living after death as a devourer in darkness. Such a thing had it become, and from this shunned, accursed tomb, he had sent the call to the descending generations, that when they came, there might be a ghastly feast whereby it might continue a dread eternal life. Basically, you can be immortal, but you gotta munch on your kin. Every so often to be immortal. The thing laughs really hard. The narrator freezes with fear. He can't move. The thing sits up, reaches out with his scary arms and grabs the narrator around the throat and starts to choke him.
The monster's whole plan is to keep luring his descendants to the tomb over time so he can eat up on them, which I thought was kind of a cool twist.
Yeah.
You do discover the secret of immortality. It only works for him. It doesn't work for you.
Yeah. You don't get a chance to apply it.
Yeah.
He's about ready to be choked out, but then for some reason the spell breaks and he's able to control himself and he's not frozen anymore and he just freaking punches the thing right in the face. And he punches it so hard its face caves in. And then he grabs it, pulls it out of the coffin and totally does this body slam.
Mm-hmm.
Slams it onto the floor, it breaks and stuff, and then he gets up on the ropes and he does a superfly snooker.
He totally does, man. And you know the thing's just going, ow! Ow! Somehow he was able to break the spell. I think he just looked away from the monster's eyes because its powers are all mental.
Yeah.
But apparently looking away was something that the last seven generations couldn't come up with.
No.
When they got in this situation, only he was able to think about doing that.
But it's still moving. Like its hand is crawling across the floor and stuff.
Right.
So he sets the thing on fire and he just runs out of there.
The tomb is raised now, and with it the forest graves and all the hidden chambers and manuscripts that serve as a reminder of ghoul-ridden memories that can never be forgot. For Earth hides a madness, and dreams a hideous reality, and monstrous things abide in the shadows of death, lurking and waiting to seize the souls of those who meddle with forbidden things.
And that is the end of the story.
One question I have.
Sure.
Why only the eldest sons?
Well, maybe that's all he needs.
I mean, I would think let's cast a spell on the whole family, get everybody up there, more food.
Well, you need them to reproduce.
That's true.
So you can't eat them all, because if you eat them all, then you're done, and that's it. You die eventually.
It doesn't have to be your family?
Well, according to the ritual, it seems to be the case, I guess. No, I don't know. Well,
all right, here, another question. What is that monster? Is that monster hanging out in that tomb all the time, and the only time it wakes up and talks is when they show up?
Yep.
Because why get eternal life if you're just going to lay around in a box?
I couldn't agree more.
Does it leave? Maybe it leaves and comes back, and then hides in there like it's a surprise party when it knows that the food is coming.
Yeah, I don't. It really doesn't seem like it's worth it, really, to just lay in a coffin,
hungry
for hundreds of years, hungry, waiting for a dude to show up and then eat him, and then waiting for the next guy to show up another 100 years. It's that sucks.
That does suck. I still enjoyed that story, I gotta say.
Even being 17 years old, it's still a pretty easy read, even though, of course, he's also pretending to be Lovecraft. He's really trying to crib his stuff and not doing it as well at all.
No, but better than some.
But definitely better than some.
Yeah.
So this story first appeared in the May 1935 Weird Tales. So Lovecraft got to see this thing in print.
And, you know, he wrote back and forth about different things that Block was toying around with. He was willing to have him writing in the Lovecraft universe, and that's pretty cool.
That's very cool. So I feel like that we're not going too far off the tracks with this one.
No. I mean, it's kind of nice actually doing these stories because I feel like we're back in the saddle, you know? We've been reading all kinds of different fiction, but it's nice to have those opening paragraphs where the narrator says, I dare not tell you what I'm about to tell you.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill myself because it's all too horrible. And that's kind of what we're about to deal with here in the...
That is. So let's get into the suicide in the study.
To see him sitting there in the dim-lit darkness of the study, one would have never suspected him for what he was. Wizards nowadays are not garbed in cabalistic robes of silver and black. Instead, they wear purple dressing gowns. It is not required of them that their eyebrows meet, their nails grow long as talons, and their eyes flame like emerald-imprisoned dreams. Nor are they necessarily bent and furtive and old. This one was not. He was young and slim, almost imperially straightforward. He sat beneath the lamplight in the great oak-paneled room, a dark, handsome man of perhaps 35 years of age. There was little of cruelty or malice visible in his keen, clear-featured face, and little of madness in his eyes. Yet he was a wizard, just as surely as if he lurked over human sacrifices in the skull-strewn darkness of forbidden tombs.
More wizards!
In purple dressing gowns.
That made me laugh out loud because he goes... Not like the old wizards that wear silver and black robes. No, this guy wears purple dressing gowns. I could have sworn he was going to say a suit and a tie or, you know, something more modern. But no, it's just a purple dressing gown.
Mm-hmm.
No sandals for this wizard. He's wearing Crocs.
Yeah, he's hip and he's up to date. Actually, Andrew was making some of the same jokes when we recorded last night.
They wear bow ties and sweater vests and precious little glasses.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, who do you think he's describing there?
Hey, hold on!
Something I don't know about you?
I wish I was a wizard.
That would be great.
This wizard, of course, is into scary books, and we get the litany of scary books.
So many lists of books in these Block stories. In this one, he's got in his library the Necronomicon, Mysteries of the Worm, which Block created, as you said. Mm-hmm. Also, The Black Rites of Mad Luva Karaf, Priest of Bast. Listen to the name.
Uh-huh.
Luva Karaf.
It's a
play on Lovecraft.
Yeah, yeah. And Priest of Bast. Bast is the cat god.
Right. So Lovecraft, the cat lover, wrote that book.
I see.
And I think even H.P. would sign his letters with Luva Karaf sometimes when he was writing to Block. So it was a little joke between them. There's also Culte des Ghouls by Comte Dirleth.
Right.
Which is also making fun of an author's name. Can you tell me?
Dirleth.
August Dirleth. Yeah. But anyway, this handsome wizard, he's got a good library. That's the point.
Yes, and he knows magic. He knows scary things. This wizard is James Allington. Tonight is writing in his journal in a lock study. And I think you know where this is going because of the title of the story. But we get into his journal entry. He's going to do a test to split himself into two minds using hypnotism. He says that Stevenson was only partially right in his book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There is a good half and an evil half in everyone.
Right.
He spends a good paragraph monologuing on how the other's laughed at him. You know, the other people thought his idea was crazy and he's a genius and they're all fools. And someday he will show them how stupid they are and how awesome he is. Very enjoyable, though.
Typical mad scientist stuff.
I love that stuff. Thing is, this isn't just a separation of the mind, but he will physically separate into two beings.
Two bodies,
yeah. He thinks doing this will open up new knowledge for him. He'll be able to figure out how to be immortal. And this, of course, I don't really understand how splitting into two people would make you smarter. I thought you would maybe be two people half as intelligent.
Right, I don't. It says, once I do this, it's going to give me all this power. But I don't understand why.
Why would it give him power?
There are practical applications for this, maybe. If you're the kind of person you enjoy ice cream, but it gives you a tummy ache.
Yes, there
you
go.
Use the hypnosis, split off into one person who likes ice cream and one person who has tummy aches.
Or maybe if he was like, I'm going to split my consciousness into the stupid parts of me and the smart parts of me. And the stupid parts of me will quit clogging up the smart parts of me and I'll be just uber smart. But he doesn't say that. He says the good and the evil.
Yeah, and they're both going to be around, and that's going to be great, and it's going to give me all this power. I can't remember, was Dr. Jekyll doing it because he wanted to exterminate the evil in himself? Like, you'd split?
Well, I've never read it. Rachel's read it.
Oh, we need to cover it sometime. It's actually it's a great book.
Rachel read it just recently. She picked it up and was like, oh, yeah, and just, like, out of the blue, was like, I'm going to read this, and she read it, and she goes, yeah, it's really good. I'm like, I think it was when she was studying psychology that she was like, oh, I should check that book out.
It's a really quick read. It's a good one. Anyhow, it makes no sense. That's the point.
Yes.
What this guy's plan is, he's going to split himself into two beings, one good, one evil. After that, for some reason, he'll know the secrets of the universe.
So he wonders what evil will look like. You know, maybe it'll be ugly. I mean, I think it's strange that he doesn't even consider the idea that it'll look just like him, but with a Van Dyke.
With a little goatee.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've learned from Star Trek that that's the way it works.
Exactly.
It's either eyeliner or goatee. Could be both.
Could be both,
that's
yes.
What the evil version of
the eyeliner, I forgot about that. So he knows that evil is going to be powerful. But he's kept his own personal evil in check all these years, so of course he's going to be able to handle it.
Handle it, but he also is, I think he's going to send his evil self out to go kill all the skeptical friends.
No.
Or something. And he also has a really weird way to hypnotize himself. I've never heard of this one before. He says, I shall try to induce a hypnotic trance by concentrating intently on this heavy, polished paper knife here on my desk.
Yeah. I know that for some hypnotism stuff, it's always some focal point. There's got to be something for them to focus on. And it could be a shiny thing. It could be a watch going back and forth or a metronome or whatever. I don't know about hypnotizing yourself. Is that something people do?
People say they can do that, yeah.
Okay.
But why not a candle or a medallion? I don't understand, like, a weapon, a clear weapon.
Well, I think I know why they're picking on the... Because it's going to come right. It's going to come into play.
But he's overconfident, I guess, is the issue, right?
Of course. He says, nothing shall go wrong. However, I have used auto-hypnosis many times before, and I will be very careful. It will be a marvelous feeling to control two bodies at once. I can hardly control myself. I find my body trembling with eagerness and anticipation of its forthcoming metamorphosis. Power. I love it. He says, one sentence is, I'm going to be able to control myself. Next sentence, I can hardly control myself.
In that paragraph, my favorite sentence is just one word and an exclamation point. Power.
So now we go into the next chapter. I mean, this is a very short story, so I don't understand why it's broken into chapters, but it is. So he sits at his desk and he uses his little shiny letter opener to focus on, and he does his hypnosis. He dips into unconsciousness and then he awakes, and he knows something is in the room with him, but he can't move. He can only look around. First, he notices he shrunk. He's like less than a quarter of his normal size, and that's like a foot and a half or a foot and three quarters.
Yeah.
So he's like tiny. He's little.
He's like Dorf on golf. In all these big clothes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's just floating around in his big clothes. But the thing that he sees is a monstrous, hairy figure, huge, grotesque simian, a hideous travesty of all things human. It was black madness, slavering, mocking madness, with little red eyes of wisdom old and evil, leering snout and yellow fangs of grimacing death. It was like a rotting living skull upon the body of a black ape. It was grisly and wicked, troglodytic and wise.
It was both a trog and it was wise. Insane. It had all the lust, the greed, the insane ambition, the cruelty, the ignorance. The fiend spawned secrets of his soul within the body of a gigantic ape.
Yeah, so then at that point he realizes how badly he screwed up. And that there's no controlling this thing.
Yeah, his evil side was clearly a lot more dominant. Which it seemed like he knew, but he didn't really think it through.
Yeah.
It says in the story, as if in answer to this recognition, the creature laughed, and tentacles of horror gripped the wizard's heart.
The thing was coming toward him. It meant to destroy him, as evil always does. Allington, his tiny body ludicrously struggling to move quickly while impeded by clothes now ridiculously large for his diminutive frame, raced from his chair and flattened himself against the wall of the study. His voice, curiously treble, shrieked frantic supplication and futile commands to the approaching nemesis. His prayers and curses turned to the hoarse gibberings of madness as the huge beast lunged across the table. His experiment was succeeding with a vengeance. Vengeance. His glaring eyes watched, fascinated, as one great paw grasped the paper knife and fearsome laughter riddled the night. It was laughing, laughing. Somewhere an alarm clock rang, but the wizard could not hear. They found James Allington lying dead upon his study floor. There was a paper knife embedded in his breast, and they called it suicide, for no one could possibly have entered that locked and windowless room. But that did not explain the fingerprints on the handle of the knife. The terrible fingerprints. Like those left by the hand of a gigantic ape.
And that's the end of the story.
Whoa.
The italicized like those left by the hand of a gigantic ape.
So somehow the ape recombined with him in the dead
I
body?
Guess so. Because they didn't say that they found a little tiny body, like a little dude.
He died of being shrunken.
The evil side killed himself. What good did that do the evil self? Because he died as well.
They should have found the little body and they said,
yeah.
Somebody down at the Pavilions grocery store said there was an ape shopping. that would have been the horrific conclusion.
He was getting egos.
I didn't realize until the last minute that we were even covering this story.
Yeah.
You had picked all the stories for the month.
Yeah.
And I looked at the list. I read them all this weekend. And picked out readings for Andrew to do
sure. In
the session last night. But I missed this one because we were doing a twofer and I didn't realize it.
Oh.
Until the last minute. But luckily, you'd highlighted the two passages, the opening paragraph and this ending.
Yeah.
So I just knew I had to get these recorded. But neither I nor Andrew knew what this story was about. We just recorded those two sections. So that's why, if you don't cut after Andrew finishes the last reading, that's why it sounds like this.
Like those left by the hand of a gigantic ape.
I kind of love that we haven't read the story.
I have no idea.
All we get is the beginning and the end. And really, do we need more?
Why did he shrink? And so, all right, so we're laughing so hard because if you just read those two paragraphs, all I know from the beginning is there's some modern wizard. And then in the end, he's like shrunk down and he's getting attacked by a gorilla with a letter opener. It's like, what? How did we get from there to here? It makes no sense. And you know, when I read the whole story this morning and it filled in some of those blanks, although it kind of still didn't make any sense.
No, this story doesn't really make any sense.
But in the abbreviated way that Andrew and I read it, it was actually much more successful of a story.
Yeah.
Because we speculated for a long time on what could have happened.
It's the first story was better, but this story was still enjoyable. I read it and it amused me.
Absolutely. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like I know this guy, this kid who was writing this stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I thought all these things were great ideas too.
Can you imagine being 17 years old and writing this stuff and sending it into a paper, writing to other established authors that you respected, whose work you've read?
Yeah.
And rewriting and taking suggestions. And like, I was, all I ever cared about when I was 17 is freaking Star Trek and role-playing game. I wasn't working this hard. This kid was working hard.
Well, I think at that age, I know I was already writing imitative horror stories.
Sure.
Like I wrote one around this time called The Tint of the Marble.
The what?
The Tint of the Marble. And it was like, I mean, I really think it, I like how I'm pretending I don't know what this was about. It was, there was a...
out with it.
The concept was, you know how sometimes when you wash whites with red clothing, they come out a little pink.
Okay.
And that had happened in the story, and he had fired this housekeeper because of it. He was, you know, interviewing the new housekeeper, and he shows her the bathroom, and she looks, and the marble of the tub is tinted with this pink. And she thinks, why is that? And then he like kills her in the bathtub.
What?
And it's because there'd been blood in there the whole time. And so the marble was tinted with the blood. And that was the horrific conclusion. I was trying my hand at these kinds of things, but they were terrible and stupid. And I wasn't pulling it off even nearly as well.
Yeah.
As Block was,
no.
Even in his, you know, slavish Lovecraftian imitations, he's still writing a coherent, if not completely sensible, really fun.
It's fun. That is, story. It's fun. It's really fun.
I just enjoy the heck out of reading these, and they're all really similar too. The one that we're going to cover next week, we're doing a story called "The Grinning Ghoul."
Yeah,
and it's the same kind of thing. There's a tomb with tunnels under, and there's more ghouls. And you know that when you're getting into it. But I could probably read 50 of those. For some reason, they're so entertaining.
They're so entertaining. I don't get it. I don't know. It trips all of those little tiny triggers for me. Maybe it's because I love Lovecraft so much. And this distills down a lot of the things that I like about Lovecraft in a fun way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all the tropes are there again. You know, the narrator fainting and not remembering everything. The all the words, you know, the certain this and the
right.
books. And the,
yeah, the litany of scary books is... Every
the
story.
Nitrous, yeah, the moon, and I, you know, all of that stuff is there, and so it's like a little return to Lovecraft country. But you don't know the story, so who knows what's going to happen?
Exactly.
Is it
going to
be like The Hound, or is it going to be like Rats in the Walls?
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery.
So I want to thank Andrew for not only reading but for participating. We're using those extra little sound bites there. It was really good to hear him as always, because I miss that guy being in the UK. He's a delight.
Yeah.
Next week. The Grinning Ghoul. I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
Please join us again here at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.